All right, Dr. Mike Barnes, PhD family therapist. I appreciate you for being here and spending some time with us.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'll let you speak on your behalf. Can you give us your credentials and what you're currently up to?
Sure. I've been an addiction counselor for 42 years, and I have a PhD in marriage and family therapy and a master's in counseling. And I'm a licensed addiction counselor and a licensed professional counselor in Colorado. And I've been, you know, I've had a really interesting kind of varied career. I've been a college professor and basically a clinical director, chief clinical officer of treatment centers. Most recently, I was the chief clinical officer at an addiction program for men in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, called Foundry Steamboat. Mm-hmm. And that program is now part of a kind of a network of programs called NRT Behavioral Health, which stands for the Next Right Thing. And it's also in Colorado. And I am I'm a consultant for NRT, and I am the director and the founder of the Michael Barnes Family Institute. My real passion over the years has been kind of helping families get on board with the recovery process. And wow. I think so many programs, you know, tell families they need to be involved to support their loved one's recovery. And I think that's kind of almost an antiquated idea at this point, that the research would tell us that, you know, families say all the time, you know, if he would just get sober, we could go back to normal.
And it ain't that easy, sister.
Yeah, that's not how it works. And the research now says that an individual with a chronic disease, like addiction, actually manages that illness in a far more effective way when the family comes into recovery at the same time.
Yeah, that makes
sense. Really support been my system. Yeah, that's my what I've been doing the last 2 years.
Boy, you went heavy into it. So why did you get into this? Did something in your personal life happen, or have you just always been like an empathetic person, like an empath, or what's the deal?
Well, I grew up in a family with addiction. My grandfather was a pretty chronic alcoholic, died at age 64
Oh, wow.
from his illness. And my mother, his daughter, had been pretty severely traumatized in that process. And her mother died when she was very young, and just the chaos of living in a family with addiction. And it's interesting, growing up, I didn't know our family had, you know, I thought we were just normal family, right? And but I kept being drawn to this counseling thing. And I kind of in hindsight realized I was probably a counselor from the time I was 7 or 8 years old, sort of taking care of the needs of the family people around me, but in that process, never really developing a very healthy sense of self. You know, that I was valuable when I was perfect. I was valuable when I did all the right things, rather than, you know, it's okay to not be okay. And when I was in my doctoral program, my goal, I went to Florida State University, and I was studying with like one of the top trauma guys in the world. At the time. And so I was really looking to study trauma in the addiction world. And then my son, who is now 38 years old, ran out in front of a car and was hit, and severe life-threatening injuries. And over the course of time, I really realized how, so he got hit, my wife witnessed it, I didn't witness it, but I went through all the intensive care stuff, and that we were all traumatized in really different ways from the same event. And so my interest in studying trauma moved away from the traumatized individual to the family members, and how the trauma of the family actually gets in the way of the recovery of the individual client, or the survivor of the trauma. And that quickly began to feel very similar to what the families that I work with addiction experienced. And so I shifted back to really looking at what we call the secondary trauma of families of individuals who struggle with addiction. And, you know, there's so much associated trauma for the primary substance use disordered family member. And so that's really what got me on the path that I'm on now, was this pretty catastrophic event and how different we all saw it.
Is your son okay?
Yeah, he's fine. He's, played high school sport. Like he played high school football and sports and went to college. He's a lawyer. And so,
he's doing quite all right.
Yeah, he's doing okay. But I'll be honest with you, if we as parents had not begun to recognize how our need to control and to prevent anything bad from happening again was really creating a learned helplessness in him, in that idea of almost trying to bubble wrap him so that we didn't have to go through another event of any kind. And we began to realize how much damage we were doing to him, and felt that family recovery was the only way to resolve it.
Yeah, that's interesting. That seems like a common thread nowadays, that there's so many people are worried, and for good reason as well, but I think maybe overbearing sometimes on like the food that they're feeding their kids, or like what activities they can do. Like, is it too much screen time? Like just living your life with anxiety about your kid. But back in like the 60s or 70s, it's like, yeah, little Marco is 3 years old. He's riding shotgun. You know, like there wasn't a care. There wasn't that big of a care like there is now. And like I said, I mean, I understand why it's there, but I think it is causing some issues to flare up, some anxiety to be held on, you know?
You know, I think that society is much more aware of trauma. And I think we live in a traumatized society, and that the helicopter parent is really a symptom of the. In my research, I found that the longer family members, parents particularly, stayed in that fight or flight response, the fear response, the more they enabled, the more enmeshed they got, the more they tried to control the kid in the family, or the person with the trauma in the family, and that actually was contraindicated, or actually made it significantly harder for that person to go into recovery from their trauma, or to go into trauma or into recovery from whatever else, the addiction and things like that. I mean, it's interesting story is, we finally realized how dysfunctional we had become when, back in the day when the Sunday paper was a big thing, and my wife said to me, do me a favor and go get the Sunday paper, which was in a box down on the road in rural Tallahassee, right by where he was hit. And my son Patrick said, no, I'll go get it. He was seven, I think, at the time, said, I'll go get it. And his mom's response was, No.
Oh, yeah.
Your dad will get it. And the seven-year-old kid looks at his mom and says, what do you think I'm going to do, run out in front of another car? It was an accident. And we looked at each other like, he's the healthiest person in this house. And I think that happens very much in the addiction world. And as professionals, we talk a lot about compassion fatigue and the idea of the relationship between burnout and exhaustion and trauma. And in professionals, but families have the same experience. And I do a lot of speaking nationally on this idea of family members actually have compassion fatigue that prevents them from relaxing the reins and giving this person a little more autonomy and say in their recovery.
Can compassion fatigue show itself in a way of like ignoring, just like you've had too much, like for example, if someone is always, they've been drinking a lot, okay, and they have an addiction to alcohol, and when they start drinking they start talking that they're going to take their own life, and it's been years and years, can it present itself the you know, just like ignoring those comments?
Yeah, that's one of the things that we do with every family, is have them take this test. and ask them what symptoms they have.
Yeah.
And how they have tried to cope with it. And that's one of the things they talk about, is just trying to pretend that everything's okay and not trying to control everything. But on the other hand, so compassion fatigue is the combination of burnout and secondary trauma. And burnout is really the result of the family organization changing. So think of addiction as a chronic progressive illness. And so you think of it from its earliest phases. There are symptoms that just look like someone who's abusing. We'll use alcohol as a simple description, or a drug of choice. And that eventually the person starts to have more and more severe symptoms. And eventually they have serious legal problems and medical problems. Well, that family is making very subtle changes from the earliest symptoms that they don't even realize they're making. And eventually they don't want to say something that's going to cause an argument. So they just avoid talking about things. Or there's so much emotion that there's all these arguments that they begin to have rules of sort of like, don't talk about things. Don't let your emotions out. Be careful what you say and how you trust and things like that. And over the course of time, the family, the parents, the adults in the system who are supposed to be making sure everything's okay are now interacting with their loved one in a way that allows them to continue to help that person, but to also try to keep all the other balls in the air with jobs and kids and all the other things. The best definition of burnout I've ever heard is this three-part definition. And the first one is this sort of dissatisfaction, this doubt, self-doubt of oneself, that I keep trying everything I can to make things better, but nothing seems to be helping. I must not be very good at this. And so they keep trying harder and harder and harder. And that's where things like control come in and hypervigilance come in, that are also associated with the trauma. Like it's a disillusionment, if you will. And so often, what's the first thing that treatment providers tell families? Well, you need to do less. You need to let them, be responsible. Well, that doesn't compute when you've been trying and trying and trying, and you now believe that you need to work harder rather than less. And so, families will all the time say to me, so what do you think we should do? And like, how should we do it? And I used to just tell them. And then I started paying attention, and I started asking, if I tell you, will you do it? And the average answer is, well, it depends on what you tell me. And so they don't really want to know in order to follow something different or to do something different. They want to know if you're on the same page. They want to know if they're going to be supported. They in some cases, they want to push back and say, well, we've already tried all of those things. And a guy by the name of Simon Sinek, who has written a lot of books, he's a thought leader, wrote a book many years ago called It Starts With Why. And what he said was that people will always ask you what to do and how to do it, but they won't do it until you've kind of helped them understand why they should do anything. And so I think as we talk about recovery for individuals and families, that's where I like to start. What is their understanding of what they have? What's the problem that they're trying to solve?
Sure.
And whose job is it to take any of these steps? Because just telling people what to do is not a very effective way to initiate change. Helping them begin to wrestle with the fact that they've been, I'm talking about families, that they have been impacted by this illness every bit as much as the loved one has. Mm-hmm. And that they're not, I'll give you a great story of a mom I was talking to recently. Sorry, I'm just rattling on, but.
No, it's great information.
I'm really passionate about this. And the mom said, it's really interesting. We're talking about enabling, and I don't like the term enabling. I think it's pejorative. It's shaming. And I think there's much better ways of looking at it. And I think enabling is really loving behavior with usually with really bad boundaries, and that they would do the same for their other kids if they didn't have an addiction, you know, give them money and give them a place to stay if they needed it. But somehow with the addiction, we have labeled it as being a really dysfunctional thing. And that idea of helping them to begin to recognize that. So this mom had said to me, I realized that early on in my loved one's addiction, I enabled him because I loved him. And I thought, you know, he's really struggling and he's trying and nothing's going his way. So I'm just going to try to pave the way to make his life a little easier. And then he'll figure it out and he'll get this under control. And then she said, but I realized as he got deeper and deeper into his addiction, that he became predictably unpredictable. And I never knew what he was going to do. And I started to enable him because I feared him. I feared what was going to happen if I didn't protect him or protect others from him in the course of his addiction. And so this idea of really kind of helping families begin to look at, this isn't just about your loved one. It's as much about them as it is their loved one. And families, once they see it, then we see this big shift into more of a family recovery scenario, which is where the healing happens.
So you would say that if there's someone that has a substance problem within a family, that every family member would probably need therapy on top of that.
Yeah, that's one of those questions people ask. Also is, well, what if everyone in the family isn't willing to do that?
Yeah, exactly. Right.
And I always think, you know, we've all seen a mobile that hangs over a baby's crib. And we all know that if you hit one of those elements on that mobile, that the whole mobile begins to shift, trying to regain balance, kind of what we call homeostasis. And I have found that if I can get one family member to come into our program and be really willing that regardless of how everyone in the family responds to them, continue to insist that their changes stay, that the family will often begin to shift with them as opposed to against them. Meaning, other family members will suddenly call and say, can I be in that group too? I'm really watching my sister who's making these really incredible positive changes. And so you don't need the whole family to agree. You need one person who's willing to change that creates kind of an unbalance in the family to where other members, it becomes too uncomfortable not to make those same shifts.
Yeah. Right. When you're dealing with someone that's addicted to drugs and alcohol, what steps are you trying to take? Like, are you trying to find the root cause, which is going to give some closure to that individual? Like, how do we get the person off of the substance? Like, what, I know it's probably going to be different for everybody, but is there some kind of methodology behind it? Like, are you trying to find some kind of root cause to why they got there in the first place?
You know, many, many years ago, the answer to that would have been no. Like the answer is you're an addict, and it doesn't matter why you do things. It just matters that you do things and that you need to come to terms with those. And these days, you know, we kind of looked that there are three ways that people become addicted. And this is the work of Paul Early, who's a fellow in the American Society of Addiction Medicine. And he said the three ways that people become addicted are through genetics, you know, passing transgenerational likelihood or susceptibility. And we now look at what we call epigenetics, which is how the environment that the person lives in either turns those genes off or turns those genes off.
Whoa.
Or turns them on or turns them off. And so if my grandfather was an alcoholic and I grew up in a family that was not a lot of arguing and not a lot of conflict, And it was calm, and my parents attached to me and taught me how to deter gratification and how to feel my feelings and all those things, that the likelihood that those genes will be turned on is less likely.
Even if they were drinking? Even if they were alcoholics at that time?
No, no, I'm talking about the formation of the alcoholism, meaning that kid or that person probably, even if they used a little bit or used socially, may not or probably will not develop addiction. And some of that comes out of twin studies that they did years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Where they had kids that were these identical twins who had identical DNA, and they were being adopted. So they were kind of following along with these kids. And they found that if one of the identical twins was adopted by a family that did not have addiction, that they were less likely to develop addiction, even though they had the genetic predisposition for it, and that the kids who were adopted into family systems that had addiction were more likely. And so that it wasn't just the genetics, it was the environment, the amount of stress, the amount of conflict that would turn those things on.
So fascinating. That's such a good study. That's an important study with the data there. Wow.
Yeah. The second way is self-medication. And so the idea that, it's interesting when I get a client who is in his 20s or in her 20s and they're kind of failure to thrive, meaning that they haven't been very successful in very much, struggled in college and all of those things because of their addiction. I'll often ask that person, so where's the trauma in your family? And they'll say, well, you know, I never had any. And then it's like, well, then who did? Oh, yeah, well, my mom had breast cancer, or my dad had a heart attack, or my dad lost his job, or someone had to, was in a car accident. And so we kind of have this belief that the primary trauma has to happen to the client, when that's not always the case. And the idea of growing up in a traumatized family system, with the concept of secondary trauma, that the kids may be experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder or symptoms and start self-medicating with drugs and alcohol. And it's interesting for those guys, those kids, young adults, we talk about treatment as being rehabilitation. Well, I don't think that rehabilitation is sufficient for those guys. I think they need habilitation. And so for a lot of these individuals who have been self-medicating since they were teenagers and sort of out of control behavior, that the normal developmental stages that we go through that allow us to develop a healthy prefrontal cortex, healthy decision-making, attachment, connection to our emotional state, the ability to regulate our autonomic nervous system, that if we don't learn to do that as age-appropriate adolescents moving into adulthood, that when they get sober at age 25, I've had multiple clients. I had a guy who was 38 years old who heard one of my presentations call me and say, that's exactly my life. I've been in 15 treatments.
Yeah.
And I get sober, but then I realize I don't know how to do anything, and that I don't know how to be an adult. I haven't paid my bills. I haven't held a job. I've never bought a car, those kinds of things. And so often they relapse because of shame and because of the fear of not living up to expectations. And their families will often call and say, don't get me wrong. I'm really grateful that my son or daughter is sober, but boy, when they talk, they sound like they're 15 years old. When are they going to be adults? And the answer to that is, whenever they are in a safe place in early recovery that allows them to learn how to do those things. And that's why our advancements in looking at the continuum of care are so important, and the idea of sober living, and not just housing, but sober living in a way that allows them to have mentorship into the adulting process that really helps them begin to move into that recovery state rather than just sobriety. And so that's the second. And then the third one is just living in an environment where being intoxicated and seeing intoxication and watching arguing and watching, you know, think of adverse childhood events. That's a big thing right now where we look at how much trauma kids have had. And there was a study that said if an individual has four or more childhood traumas, and it's not like getting hit by a car necessarily, it's neglect and emotional abuse and physical abuse and parental arguing and domestic violence and those kinds of things, that they have a significantly higher likelihood of becoming chemically dependent, that they are significantly higher rates of depression, significantly higher rates of medical conditions like diabetes and cancer and heart disease that promote early death. And so the third way is just really being so habituated into a conflicted situation and a state where what they think is normal substance use is not normal substance use, then they have a much higher likelihood of becoming addicted. And we see those people all the time who grew up in poverty, who they don't know any different. They can't even imagine what sobriety would look like.
Yeah, in some cases it's scary, isn't it? It's
terrifying.
Right. Yeah.
And they're terrified, but they look sometimes really angry because, you know, anger is a secondary feeling in many cases where it's usually caused by fear or threat, frustration, hurt, shame, guilt, those kinds of things that, and I think it's why a lot of people leave treatment against medical advice and drop out of treatment because they're beginning to, I was having this conversation today with someone from our treatment center, and they were talking about, we were talking about, do our clients, we're getting a lot of these same clients that we're talking about right now, mm-hmm. do they even have a picture of what sobriety would look like? It's kind of hard. It's kind of hard to achieve something where you can't even picture it. And so that's where we're really beginning to focus our therapy on giving them solution, giving them opportunities to identify hope and to identify what a future without drugs and alcohol could look like.
Wow. Yeah. That mentorship is, that could be key. Jeez. Yeah. I mean, that's just like every aspect in life too. Like how could someone be successful if they don't know what success looks like?
Yeah, I mean, never seen it.
Yeah. Right. If you've never seen it, you don't know what it looks like. So you kind of just fall into place and, you know, just drift through this life that you know, that all of you've seen.
Yeah. And that's what we see more and more today, particularly with younger, some of the younger folks coming into treatment that.
More than ever? Like, are we seeing upticks nowadays?
Well, I think that the treatment has been made, you know, in the old days, there was a time where, you know, the population is 1 in 10 people in the United States have an addiction. And for many, many years, less than 10% of that 1% ever walked in the front door of a treatment center. And so now there's a lot more treatment. There's the number of programs is growing all of the time. And I think we're just seeing a lot more people that maybe would not have gotten to treatment they hadn't gone to jail or they hadn't gotten arrested. Or so often they're being referred to us out of environments that are more public safety than health oriented.
I'm curious to know what your thought is on this. I don't know where I heard it from, but I do remember I heard it. But the person was saying that it might have been a cop. I don't know. But they're like, these people, we get like consecutive calls and repeat offenders, and it's usually the same person. And we go to them, we talk to them, and then we just let them go, you know? But then their point was like, what if we just took them to jail and then they would have to get clean that way. And I just wanted to know what you thought about that. Instead of just reliving the cycle, you know, just go there, see what's up. All right, nothing. All right, go do your thing. Go overdose. We'll be back. Maybe it was a paramedic.
Well, I think that's frustration talking in most cases. First of all, the drugs that, you know, so many clients are using. So with the internet, you can buy benzos over the internet, and you can buy any drug you want. And to just put someone in jail without any real medical detox actually puts them into pretty grave danger in some cases.
For sure.
And so particularly with alcohol, I mean, there's two drugs that that in your detox that you have a chance of dying. And one is alcohol and one is benzodiazepines.
Yeah. I was on a benzodiazepine, and man, that's a scary one right there. I accidentally got, not addicted, but well, it's kind of addicted. What's it called when you have to keep taking it? It's not addicted, but.
Well, you develop tolerance and withdrawal.
There's tolerance. Yeah, definitely. But yeah, when I ran out of the prescription, all of a sudden I started, like, you want to talk about fear? I was having so much fear and anxiety and panic attacks, and like, I did not feel okay at all. Dependence, that was the word I was looking for.
Yeah. Well, and what's the worst that can happen in a jail setting? I mean, if someone's that agitated and that fearful and not thinking very clearly. I mean, just so many really bad things can happen. And what we're finding is that we're getting a lot of referrals from law enforcement. I can't think of the term, but in lieu of going to jail, going to treatment. And so we've been very Colorado has been a really forward thinking state, and their Medicaid programs really, our lengths of stay for Medicaid clients is very long. We have them for sometimes 3 months. And so there's a lot we can do in that period of time. And one of them is, you know, that benzo taper that you were talking about.
Yeah.
Is a long process.
It is, yeah.
And jails want no part of that. And it's the same thing with like opiate withdrawal. It's not going to kill you, but it will make you as sick as you've ever been in your life. And, you know, I think when I hear law enforcement talk about that, and I hear particularly EMTs talk about that, and boy, the life of an EMT, they're dealing with so many. Right. I lived in downtown Denver for a long time, right in the middle of the homelessness. I wanted to see it. I had never been around it. And the police were Narcanning people left and right all day. And so I can see their that's more frustration talking than a very reasonable intervention.
Yeah. You think you just become like disassociated when you start Narcanning people that much? Like it just becomes a number? Or do you think, I don't know.
Well, that was the big argument against Narcan in the recovery. Like the recovery community was not a big fan of, well, they were a fan of Narcan, but like Suboxone and medication assisted therapy. And a lot of people believe that you were just prolonging the inevitable, that they were going to have to get off of it at some point. And I'll tell you, when I would be in downtown Denver, I would walk around people that I had to think, is that person alive or is that person dead?
Oh, jeez.
And yeah, you can get, particularly the EMTs, in that they become a bit calloused, and it's not really they don't see it as treatment. They just see it as an intervention, but they're going to see the next guy do it again. You know, it's one of the interesting things that clients are telling us is that they're doing their opiates or their fentanyl in teams, and one person uses while the other person doesn't. And if they go into an overdose, the other person Narcans them and brings them back. And that way they're trying to
working shifts.
Yeah, prevent dying from fentanyl. It's going to be, I think it's a good, you know, clearly it saved a lot of lives. And I was talking to a mom the other day whose son asked if he could borrow the car. He was doing pretty well at the time. And he should have been home, and he hadn't come home. And they walked into the garage, and the car was sitting there. And their son was in the car dead.
Oh, shit.
And, you know, there's a reason they call Narcan the Lazarus drug, that it, you know, brings people back from the dead. And they Narcan'd him, and he responded. And I got a message from the mom recently that he's 7 months sober and working, went to sober living, did it the right way. And now he's, you know, getting his life together. So I have nothing but good things to say about Narcan, but it isn't treatment. That's for sure. It's really just a life-saving intervention.
Yeah, it's so scary nowadays too, because of all the fentanyl that's in street drugs. That's crazy. Like, no one's, I don't, for the most part, most people that take drugs are doing it not to overdose, doing it to escape and feel better.
Yep.
Right. So,
well, and it's not just in opiates. Like, it, you know, we talk about overdose, you know, opiate overdose death, and it's not just opiates anymore. It's in cocaine, it's in other drugs. And there's a very famous court case where five or six people were just partying on a Friday evening. Someone brought some cocaine and they all died.
Oh, and was that in California?
No, that was in Aurora, Colorado.
Oh, wow. That's so unfortunate. That's so bad. Oh, that sucks.
Yeah, I live in Tampa now. And, you know, it's the same. There's a homelessness issue, but there, it's not anywhere near what Denver was.
Yeah. Wow. In your mind, is there a difference between, like, I don't know how to word this exactly, but recreational drug use and addiction? And where I'm, let me try to, I'll just briefly go in detail about it. So what if you're on Xanax for, let's say you've been prescribed, but you've been on it for 6 years, you know, that to me, that seems like you're not getting to the root of the cause. And it seems like an addiction because it's been so long. But if you're using it as prescribed, that person may not see it as an addiction or as, like, you're dependent on it. You know, there's a lot of cases where it's like, well, I'm using it as my doctor prescribed, so nothing's wrong here.
So, you know, when we think about giving a diagnosis of a substance use disorder, there are 11 things that we look at that would be indications that the person isn't using it the way it was designed. Things like using in larger amounts over longer periods of time than intended, you know, gradually getting the doctor to give more and more of the medication, taking it as prescribed, but higher doses. Unsuccessful efforts to cut down and control. A lot of time spent worrying about the drug. I'm almost out. And then beginning to have anxiety at the thought of not having the drug. Strong cravings, those kinds of things. And so I think we see this a lot with pain management clients too, where they've been on opiates for very long periods of time and they take them as prescribed, but they're clearly dependent, and to not take them would be a very significant withdrawal process. And so, you know, I think there is such thing as recreational drug use, but I think if there's tolerance, meaning they need more to get the same effect, even if it's not to get intoxicated, even if it's just to deal with their pain, that that's problematic. And if they're taking it for such a long period of time that if they were to not be able to take it, that they would have significant consequences. And I have a person I just met recently who had that exact scenario. Mm-hmm. Was in bad car accidents and had been on opiates for 15 years.
Oh, geez.
And and her mind took them exactly as prescribed. Even the thought of getting off of them was terrifying for her. So it's not the same kind of substance use disorder, but there's certainly many of the same characteristics of treatment, meaning helping them to get off the medications, teaching them better coping skills, dialectical behavior skills of distress tolerance, and holistic activities, mindfulness, massage, acupuncture, things like that. And so I worked with a case recently with someone very much like that. And we worked as a team, physician, some holistic practitioners. I was more of a consultant on the case. But we built a program that was kind of like a rehab for this person. But it wasn't specific to addiction so much as it was the medical complications of long-term drug use on the physical being.
Mm-hmm. Right. Do you think that if drugs weren't available, that people would still find something else to do or to use to try to escape? Because when I hear like so many people are on opioids, like that tells me that, like, initially what I hear is that we have a sick society. Like, people are really unhappy. People aren't pleased with their environment. I know it's not, you can't shade everything black and white, a lot of gray areas, but that's on the surface kind of what I see.
So if you think about the part of the brain that drugs and alcohol work on, and it's called the mesolimbic dopamine reward system. And when the scientists from McGill University in Montreal found this part of the brain, they thought they had found the cure for depression. When they gave rats the opportunity to press a lever to get a shock to that part of the brain to release dopamine, which is what people who are addicted to drugs are trying to get, that sense of pleasure or relief, that it was unfortunate, but the rats kept pressing the brain until they were dead. And so they began to look at it as just part of a system of self, the maintenance of the human animal, if you will, kind of sex, procreation, food, all of the things that we do to feel better. And that over time, the drug of choice begins to override some of these other responsibilities. And that's really where we begin to see the addictive process. So we have to think about what we call process addictions or behavioral addictions, things like sex, sexual addiction, pornography addiction. We estimate that anywhere from 40 to 60% of the clients who come into our program, as well as having a chemical dependency of some kind or a substance misuse disorder, they also have a behavioral disorder. It's either sex, it's exercise, it's food, it's spending. The big one that is coming, I was talking to someone who's an expert in gambling recently, and I asked, is it as bad as I think it is? And she said, it's going to be bigger than fentanyl.
Holy shit. Whoa.
Yeah. She said the legalization of gambling.
Oh, yeah.
And gambling just has a different way of being processed in the brain. It's got a different reward structure that makes it really hard to stop. And, most clients who have these sort of co-occurring process addictions will relapse on their process addiction first, meaning, well, I can watch some pornographic videos if I'm down. It's not like I'm, drinking. It's not like I'm using my drug of choice. But over the course of time, it doesn't have the same exact same response. So they'll often relapse back into their drug of choice. And so there's a term now that we call addiction interaction disorder. And it's basically looking at all of the ways that the dopamine and glutamate, which is another really important neurotransmitter that kind of has to do with the way the nervous system communicates. And that for some people, they go from one to the other. Some have a mixture of multiple different kinds of addictive processes to get the same effect. And so oftentimes clients will say, that's not why I'm in treatment. I'm not in treatment for gambling. I'm in treatment for my substance abuse, and I'm not going to focus on those other things. But it's really important for them to begin to recognize that anything that releases that dopamine release process or stimulates that process is needs to be addressed.
So with that being said, do you forecast in the future that phone withdrawal, like social media apps, are going to need some kind of rehab? I mean, essentially, it's a dopamine button.
We already have them, and they're more for gamers. And the original program started in Asia because there's so much gaming and so much computer use that they I was reading an article about where they were watching these individuals in treatment for gaming when they were sleeping, and that they were there. You could see their hands and like they were holding a controller were sleeping.
Oh no.
And that they were dreaming about gaming, and their fingers were actually working like an invisible controller. And so, yeah, I think that that's another one of the up and coming things is social media, gaming. Think about social media, and like someone posts a meme of some kind, and then they go back and check Facebook 10 times to see if anyone liked it. Well, that's the same process of compulsion to use. And so I like the old definition of addiction the best. I think it just speaks to it. And it's a three-part definition. And the first one is compulsion to use. And in the early days of compulsion, it becomes more and more a normal part of partying, a normal way of socializing. Over the course of time, it becomes they won't go to certain restaurants if they can't drink, or they won't go to certain activities if there aren't going to be drugs there. And then as the disease progresses, the compulsion becomes, if I don't use, I'm going to get sick. And it's just the same process. It just gets more and more complicated. The second one is use despite adverse consequences. And that idea of, that the first few times it's terrifying and I'm never going to do that again. I don't need that kind of problem, but they have compulsion. So they slowly, gradually go back to doing what they did. And then the last one is compulsion. So the last one is use despite adverse consequences. The second one is loss of control. And loss of control is that idea of can you predict beyond a shadow of a doubt what's going to happen once you consume a drug? And, over the course of time, people lose control and use when they didn't mean to use, or use more than they meant to use and have consequences. And so if you think of that as a spiral, so compulsion to use that leads to loss of control, that leads to problems, that leads to use again, even though you have those problems, because you have compulsion, it's just is this death spiral into the depths of addiction. And it doesn't matter what the drug is.
Right.
It's the same process.
I think we're I think we're setting our youth up for a real problem with that with the gambling stuff, because it's so accessible from your phone. I'm talking sports gambling.
Yep.
Sports is such a giant thing, and it's like the biggest podcasters and everything on. If you're watching sports TV, I mean, there's giant ads for this stuff. Like how simple it is, and get like $500 to bet now. It's yeah. So it's like you're gonna start getting people addicted at 17, 18 years old, and your frontal cortex is not even fully developed, right?
Yeah, the prefrontal cortex does not develop in women until 28 or 26.
Yeah.
And men 27, 28. And so, you know, what does the prefrontal cortex does so many different things, but it's involved in memory, it's involved in decision making, it's involved in being able to step back from a decision and really think it through and discern. It's involved in empathy. It's involved in so many different things that's why I like the concept of habilitation for young folks in treatment, in that if they were using before the prefrontal cortex is online fully, then they have to learn all those things in sobriety.
What about kids and tablets?
Yeah, it's a huge issue.
Yeah, right. Like, I've seen kids act out. Like personally, I've seen it happen. Like a certain individual, this young child, would not eat dinner. They were about 3 years old, unless the iPad was in front of them,
yep.
And they were freaking out if they didn't have it, and the parents would just put it in front of them to like. Let's just, we're not dealing with this shit right now. Here, take it.
Yeah. It's scary. It's really scary.
Yeah. So like what problems do you see coming from that type of, and I hate to say it, but that type of parenting, like the iPad parenting for those children?
Well, unfortunately it's going to make family participation in treatment harder, and there's going to be a lot more shame on, they'll realize that, well, we didn't know what else to do, but we could have done something rather than give them the iPad. And that's, you know, we have a group in our family program that meets every Wednesday. And I was facilitating the group this past week. And that was two of the families that were in there were just really wrestling with, man, I just didn't do as good a job as a parent as I should have done. There are certain things I should have done. I blame myself. And, you know, helping them to come to terms with, this isn't, at this point, it's not about blame. It's about change.
Sure.
It's about how do we heal. And so I think that's going to be a big implication. And, if the addictive process is happening well before pre-adolescence,
right. Yeah, that's what I'm getting at.
Yeah. Jeez. Yeah. The whole thought process is, no, what are we teaching kids that how to self-soothe? And it's interesting, you know, we tend to think of attachment as, the ability of teaching kids how to manage their emotions and how to be connected to people. And from a somatic or like somatic therapy, body-based therapy perspective, attachment happens when a child is dysregulated and a parent goes to help them, teach them to self-soothe by showing them how they regulate themselves. And so rather, I show a slide in my presentations of all these different facial expressions that adults make when they're frustrated. And the idea that if this is what every time a kid has a need, they see, you know, you're interrupting my Zoom call, or you're, I told you I'm working and you're just going to need to wait. That we have a nervous system, the polyvagal system, that plays a big role in our ability to become social beings, or to be anxious beings, or to be avoidant beings. And it really is about were my parents regulated enough to teach me as a child how to regulate? And the answer to that is no, they weren't. And so that's, I'm going to have to learn that somehow. And so we learn that often in our adolescent years, or we learn it in treatment in our young adult years, or, but we have, you know, we are social beings. And you know, so often in early recovery, clients come in and they don't even trust the therapists.
Right. Yeah, sure. I can imagine.
And so that idea of, you know, therapists have to be really curious. And there's like those first, the first few sessions are just so critical. And I tell my, when I was teaching my students, my staff, your clients are assessing you way more than you're assessing them. And so simple looks of disappointment and skepticism, and, you know, it's fine to be curious and to say, tell me more about that, or using motivational interviewing to where we kind of help them see the discrepancy between what they're saying and what they're doing. And that can be done in a way that really is very therapeutically healthy, or it can be done in pretty heavy confrontation that probably sounds and feels a whole lot like home.
Robin Williams, Matt Damon, that movie.
Yep.
Good Will Hunting.
Yep.
I'm sure you've seen it, right?
Yeah.
It's a wonderful
movie. And those are some of the greatest scenes, yeah, too. And so, yeah, I think you're right on target. That I think what we're trying to do now with the family work that we're doing is to help the next generation. You know, if we can heal this generation, you know, we're not even talking about transgenerational trauma from wars. And, you know, my aunt did our genealogy from our family coming from Ireland in 1865 or something. And when they did the family tree, they found that there was at least one active alcoholic in every generation. And but there was significant depression, and there was significant, you know, a lot of conflict and a lot of significant traumas that those do get passed from one generation to the next. Either there's a term called, God, my brain just turned off. It's getting late. well, epigenetics, the idea that there are like proteins that form on the DNA that can, when we have a lot of trauma or we have a lot of conflict, that can actually be passed from one generation to the next, that makes it difficult to manage our autonomic nervous system. And so there's been a lot of studies in Holocaust survivorship families, in Native American families, in African American families, kind of looking at the idea that the trauma could have been three generations ago, but it could still be passed from one to the other.
Boy, you just pulled all of that out with your brain turned off, and that means I'm in real trouble.
Yeah. Tell me about it. And, you know, that for me is that Irish Catholic, you know, alcoholic part of our family. You know, that was just,
yeah, know,
it impacted generations of our family.
Yeah. Yeah. I got Italian and Swedish in mine, a little bit of German.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
You know, so, and think about things like, you know, every family had that uncle that no one really talked about, and everyone left him alone. And it turns out he was a combat veteran in World War II or something and had trauma, but people didn't understand it at the time. And so there was a lot of shame about that. And I think all the talk about trauma, and I wrote a book a couple years ago called When the Solution Becomes the Problem, and meaning that how we understand the problem will dictate the solutions that make sense to us to try to fix it. And if the solutions are based on faulty thinking from previous generations, or, you know, we don't talk about these things in our family because, you know, we didn't talk about it in my family of origin, that the solutions then don't work and create other problems. And so a big part of family healing is helping them to begin to understand how these things do get passed from one generation to the next, and how it's no one's fault. It's just what happens. And that the more they can learn about it, the more they can begin to recognize it, then the more they can begin to change it. And I have a slide in my presentation of a very big circle. And that big circle is all the potential solutions to the problem that they're trying to solve. And that each person in that family has a small circle that is all they can see in that problem, meaning how my previous generations managed it, how my community that I grew up in, my family that I grew up in, they begin to set, sort of create a reality that when someone comes to me and says, "Hey, Dr. B, what do you think we should do?" And it's why I don't say what I think they should do, because my answer is going to come maybe from a different part of that circle. And if it doesn't resonate with them, then we missed an opportunity to really help them. And so now it's really helping them to recognize that new insights allow new solutions, and new solutions promote new behaviors, and new behaviors create new relationships within the family, and new relationships create family healing. And so it starts with exactly what we were just talking about, that idea of what is your belief about what this problem is. And then, the program that we have does a lot of education. And so halfway through the education, the families usually come, when we get to the part about trauma, they'll often say, "Well, I really understand my loved one's behaviors really differently. And I can see so much of what they did is tied to their trauma." And I think, well, that's a really good start. And then the family member will say, "Can I ask you a question?" And it's like, "Yeah, sure. What's the question?" "Well, I have all of those too." Mm. "Yeah, you do." And that's the next module on family trauma. And then once we can get them to be open to, "Wow, we're not as different as I thought we were."
Yeah.
Then not all bets are off, all bets are on. Now we have lots of opportunity for change.
That's beautiful. Let's go ahead and wrap it up there. That was wonderful. Dr. Mike, I appreciate you for being here. Any last words for our listeners?
My last words are, this is as hard as anything that you'll ever do. And that, so it's interesting. I kind of lurk around Facebook pages of, that are made, created by families to support one another. And so rarely do I read someone tell another person that treatment works, get them into treatment. And I want to tell you that treatment doesn't always work, but think of it in terms of layering, and that, but it's only going to work if the whole family gets treatment. And so that's the piece that I would say, is that it's not just their problem, it's everyone's problem. And that the more the family can do it together, that they become more resilient. And so treatment works. Don't be afraid to ask for help. We're growing and understanding the family's experience more today than we ever did. It's not going to be shaming. It's going to be supportive. So that's my parting hope, is that people will reach out more. And you don't have to have a loved one in treatment. Our program, not to talk too much about our program, but our program is perfect for families that their loved one just refuses to go to treatment. because it opens the door for families to understand what's going on. And again, new insights create new solutions create new behaviors. And so just like that mobile, the more you begin to change and grow yourself, the more opportunity for that family member to recognize that something's really different. And they're looking for something to be different.
Wonderful. Awesome. How can people find you, reach you? You got a website, you got social media?
Yeah, I have a website. It's www.drmikebarnes.com. And that's my personal website. And it has, it's just information. I have a YouTube channel that has all kinds of videos on addiction as a disease and trauma and family trauma. And it's at Michael F. Barnes, PhD, MAC, LPC, like all my credentials. So just look on YouTube for that. It's full of videos that you can watch and learn. And if you want to get a hold of me, my phone number is 303-885-1846.
It's kind.
And, I guess the last thing is my email address, which is mike.barnes@nrtbh.com.
Awesome. Well, listen, Dr. B, people like you, you're passionate, empathetic, you're understanding, you're kind. I mean, geez, you got so much knowledge. I can hear the paperwork going behind you. You're full of it, man. You're full of it. So I'm hopeful in a future, you know, knowing people like you are out there promoting, like, even just the opportunity to walk through a judgment-free door to better themselves and their families. So thank you for doing what you're doing. I'm glad you you found your path early on, and you kept to it, you kept on it, because you're making a difference. So Dr. Mike, appreciate you being here.
I appreciate it. Thanks for the invitation.
Of course. Thanks for spending time with us. Everyone listening, wish you the best. You got Dr. Mike's number. You got his contact information. If you or someone you know is having some turbulent times, please don't be afraid to reach out. You know, it's okay. Yep. It's okay. All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Jay.
Welcome to the Curiosity Chamber.